actually defines the word chela or disciple. Now, before moving on to the path of discipleship and the requirements and the dangers of entering a path unpreparedly, we have to make ourselves acquainted with a few fundamental conceptions given out in the theosophical literature. One such conception is the scheme of evolution in this universe and the purpose of manifestation of this universe. There is one fundamental proposition in theosophy which says that the fundamental identity of all souls, with the latter being itself an aspect of the unknown road, and the obligatory pilgrimage for every soul through the cycle of incarnation in accordance with cyclic and karmic law during the whole term. And no spiritual buddhi can have an independent conscious existence before the spark which issued from the pure essence of the universal sixth principle or the oversoul has, firstly, passed through every elemental form of the phenomenal world of the Manvantara. Individuality, first by natural impulse, and then by self-induced and self-devised efforts checked by its karma, thus ascending through all the degrees of intelligence, from the lowest to the highest manas, from mineral and plant up to the holiest archangel, Dhyani Buddha. And this doctrine of esoteric philosophy admits no privileges or special gifts in man, save those won by his own ego through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychosis and reincarnations. Now, the two points are clear on the face of it when the third fundamental proposition, which is one of the fundamental propositions of theosophy, is analyzed. First, the whole purpose of experience and emancipation of the soul. Another very important conception which comes to mind is that the Mahatmas or the Gurus were once upon a time in the ladder of evolution, were like us, were like any of us, like any other men around us. And through their self-induced and self-devised efforts, they have climbed up the ladder of evolution and reached the pinnacle of evolution by developing their physical, mental, and psychic and spiritual faculties to the utmost possible degree. And such are the ones who are called as Mahatmas or Gurus in the theosophical parlance. And that is the high state of evolution which is spoken about. So this is a basic scheme of evolution and the purpose for which there is manifestation. Having that conception in the background, it is apt that we have to consider our own natures, because each and every one of us are ultimately on that ladder to evolve into becoming the Dhyani Buddhas or Gurus. The first step in order to even begin to climb that ladder of evolution is for us to know ourselves. We are not this mere physical body. Theosophical literature clearly points out and says that the classification of our being is a sevenfold classification, wherein we have the body, the physical body or rupa. And then we have the vitality or prana jiva. We also have the astral body or linga sharira. Then comes the animal soul or kama rupa. Then comes the human soul or manas. Above which there is the spiritual soul or buddhi. And ultimately spirit or atma. And this classification stands to this day for all practical purposes. And this classification is also capable of modification and extension. For example, the author in The Ocean of Theosophy gives an example of modification of the sevenfold classification, where the astral body is placed second instead of third, and yet the constitution does not alter. So the sevenfold classification gives us an idea as to what a man is really composed of. And it is very different from the vague description which says that we have a body and a soul. It also, on the other hand, the sevenfold classification challenges the materialistic conception that we are only this physical body, and that the thoughts, the mind, is a product of brain, and brain which is a portion of the body. So the faint religious idea of man being body and soul, and the rude materialistic conception that man is only the body, both of them are tackled when we get a conception of the sevenfold classification of man. Now, considering these constituents in another manner, we can say that we can see the sevenfold classification as a lower man and a higher man. We can say that the lower man is a composite being, but in his real nature is a unity or an immortal being comprising of the higher triad or the trinity of Atma, Buddhi and Manas, as called in Sanskrit, or the spirit, spiritual soul and the human soul. This we can consider as the higher triad. And the four lower instruments, that is the animal soul, astral body, vitality and the physical body, are the mere vehicles of this higher triad. And that these four lower principles are transitory and subject to disintegration in themselves, and also separation from each other. And when the hour arrives for the separation to begin, the combination can no longer be kept up. The physical body dies. The atoms of the physical body begins to go back to the constituents of the nature from which it was derived. This is called as death among ourselves, the mortals. But there is no death for the real man, who is the Trinity, Atma, Buddhi and Manas. This Trinity is deathless, persistent and immortal, and therefore is called as a triad, while the lower quaternary, which is transitory, is called as the mortal four. Why is it that the four principles constituting the lower quaternary called as transitory? And why is it that they also are subject to the laws of disintegration? Is a matter for occult learning. And the exact methods in which they disintegrate are all described in various places in theosophical literature. But suffice to say that the real man is a thinker. He is a manas, He is a mind. He is not mere matter. So this is one of the fundamental conceptions of theosophy, which will help us to bear in mind. So far, what we have considered is that a chela, a disciple, is like a child in comparison with a guru who, through his self-induced and self-devised efforts, has moved up the ladder of evolution. And the whole purpose of manifestation of this universe is for the experience and emancipation of the man, the real man, when considered in the light of the sevenfold classification given out. So this real man, with the aid and help of the lower vehicles, which is the physical body, astral body, prana, and the desire body, is supposed to move up the ladder of evolution in the scheme. That is the scheme of the nature. And having understood what is the purpose of life, now we will consider who are these Mahatmas or Gurus, and who exactly are these disciples. And in comparison to the disciples and Mahatmas, where we stand. A Mahatma is such a person who has evolved those faculties, higher faculties, and has attained spiritual knowledge, which even we also, each and every one of us also, have the potential to acquire after passing through numberless series of incarnations during the process of cosmic evolution. Because, as was said, the purpose of the manifestation of universe is for the experience and emancipation of the soul. So we also will reach that stage of being a Mahatma through, after a long and numberless series of reincarnation. But there is a warning, there is a caveat given here. This evolution will not happen automatically. It must happen through self-induced and self-devised efforts checked by karma. Now, this process of self-evolution extends over a number of incarnations. And as we have seen, what is it that incarnates? The sevenfold classification aids us in understanding the answer to this question. What incarnates? See, the first three principles, which is the physical body, the vital body, and the astral body, is disintegrated, more or less dies at what is called as, the, for us, physical death. But the desire principle, that is something which is fully developed in each and every one of us. The fourth principle, the desire principle, along with the lower portions of the fifth principle, that is manas, desire and lower manas. Here is where resides the fully developed animal propensities. And after what is called as physical death, this desire body goes to its separate abode, and that is called as Kamaloka. And in Kamaloka, this body suffers slow disintegration. The duration of this disintegration is as much as it is proportional to the desires, the lower desires which was had. And the fifth principle, which is the higher portion of the fifth principle, manas, goes into another abode called as Swarga or Devakan in theosophical parlance, where it is completely cut off from the lower physical ordinary, and it enjoys a time of detachment, a time of rest, in proportion to the good works, good thoughts, good life led using the physical body. Now, an entity that is passing through an occult training, like a chela, who is on his way to become a Mahatma, in successive births, gradually through self-induced and self-devised efforts, has consciously made away, destroyed the lower manas and the desire body through successive births. And a point is reached where that lower body, the desire body and the lower manas, which has its all its animal propensities, is completely destroyed. And such a manas, such a man, then is entirely elevated in character and centered in the higher buddhi and the spiritual region. That is the point in which that man is said to become a Mahatma. At that time of physical death of a Mahatma, all the four lower principles perish without any suffering. For a Mahatma, all the four lower bodies are like wearing a piece of cloth. So, the fully developed mind or manas is the real Mahatma. And Mahatma is not a mere physical body, but is the higher manas, which is inseparably linked to Atma and Buddhi. So when we go around on pilgrimages to all the temples and the various churches, and we take a retreat in the hundreds of ashrams which is popping up around all of us, we try to meet some Mahatmas or Gurus, can we really meet Mahatmas by traveling from one place to another? Because a Mahatma is really a mind which has completely assimilated Buddhi and Atma, the spirit. In fact, Mahatma is not even a physical body. When people express a desire to see a Mahatma, what does it really mean? Does a Mahatma is visible to the physical eyes? Because as was said, the body of a Mahatma is a mere shell or mask, a cloth, which the Mahatma at will can throw away and put on a new one. So Mahatma is not really a physical person. And supposing one sees the body of a Mahatma, now let us imagine there may be a Mahatma as our neighbor. And we see, how can we really know the person who is a neighbor who may be a Mahatma? If we ourselves are not, don't know by what standard to judge a Mahatma. Because the physical body being the most transitory aspect, how can we really judge if a Mahatma is beside us? You see, is Mahatma just a physical body, which we can find in many places as gurus teaching and preaching and claiming to have some special powers and healing powers? Simple. The higher things, the Mahatma, the higher evolved being, can be perceived only by a sense pertaining to those higher things. Not the mere human sight. It is not possible. One has to develop the senses pertaining to that higher stage of evolution, and then one can perceive a Mahatma. So a person, whoever wants to see the real Mahatma, must use his intellectual sight. And such a person must elevate his manas, the thinking principle, the mind, to such a level that the perception will be clear. and then one can perceive Mahatma. An example is given in one of the articles of Madame Blavatsky. It says that we are just as we may be standing on a mountain top and have within our sight the whole plain, and yet not be cognizant of any particular tree or spot, because from that elevated position, all below is nearly identical. And as our attention may be drawn to something which may be dissimilar to its surroundings, in the same manner, although the whole humanity is within the mental vision of Mahatmas, they cannot be expected to take special note of every human being, unless that being, by his special acts, draws their particular attention to him. So, with our ordinary everyday perception, we cannot perceive Mahatmas until we develop our sense of perception at that stage of evolution. At the same time, Mahatmas also cannot perceive us lay human beings unless we have developed ourselves through our self-induced and self-devised efforts. So, coming to the question, the path of discipleship. How can we draw the attention of the Mahatmas to ourselves so that we can become the disciples of Mahatmas? The starting point for that is given in one sentence. The highest interest of humanity as a whole should be our special concern. Then we can draw the attention of the Mahatma. And Mahatma is, let us remember, not a physical body. Mahatma is the our higher nature, which is the same in all of us. Mahatma is the higher manas, the developed manas. So if we consider the highest interest of humanity as a whole, as our special concern, then we will draw from our higher nature, which is the Mahatma. In that process, we might actually take aid of what Madame Blavatsky has to say about duty. If we do our duty, we will come within the perception of the Mahatmas. And we are also on the path of discipleship. So let us consider a small portion from the text Key to Theosophy regarding duty. Now, the enquirer in Key to Theosophy asks, how would you define these duties or duty in general as you understand the term? What's that? Duty is that which is due to humanity, to our fellow men, neighbors, family, and especially that which we owe to all those who are poorer and more helpless than we ourselves. This is a debt which, if left unpaid during lives, leaves us spiritually insolvent and moral bankrupts in our next incarnation. Theosophy is the quintessence of duty. Well, this is a very broad principle based on which one must tread the path of discipleship. That is the path of duty, where the highest interest of humanity as a whole is the concern. Now, having considered the beginning to the path of discipleship, we have also considered about the many ashrams and what is expected of them. Most of the ashrams, they take an entry fee. Most of the ashrams, they collect hefty fees for each and every day of residence. We all know what the ashrams are doing around us. Now, having also recounted the primary interest which each and every one of us should have in the path to become a disciple, let us consider a few more requirements of a disciple. In one of the articles by Madame Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky has given out certain extracts of the requirements of a chela or a disciple. And they are seven in number. First is the perfect physical health. Second is the absolute mental and physical purity. Third is unselfishness of purpose, universal charity, pity for all animate beings. Fourth, truthfulness and unswerving faith in the law of karma, independent of any power in nature that could interfere. A law whose course is not to be obstructed by any agency, not to be caused to deviate by prayer or propitiatory exoteric ceremonies. Fifth, a courage undaunted in every emergency, even by peril to life. Six, an intuitional perception of one's being the vehicle of the manifested divine spirit. And seven, calm indifference for, but a just appreciation of everything that constitutes the objective and transitory world in its relation with and to the invisible regions. These are the basic minimum requirements which has to be fulfilled even before a person attempts to enter the path of discipleship. These are not the requirements expected of a Mahatma who is way above, way ahead in the path of evolution. These are the requirements for a person to enter into a path of discipleship, of a chelaship. So, such difficult tasks, even to start with, are expected. Now, without this initial requirement being fulfilled, if one were to rush into the path of discipleship, there are many dangers lurking around. For example, Madame Blavatsky gives many examples of the fate of the persons who rushed into the path of discipleship without heeding the advice. Many of them, even if there is a small sense of selfishness or a desire for the sensual world, then the dangers that fall upon the person on the path to discipleship is, it cannot be imagined. Death, insanity, becoming outcasts of the society, losing the mind, committing murders, committing theft, embezzling money, all sorts of things begin to happen. Madame Blavatsky says that she gives an example of a few. She says, what was the fate of the persons who rushed into the path of discipleship? One went bad in the head, recanted noble sentiments uttered, but a few weeks previously, and became a member of a religion he had scornfully and unanswerably proven false. A second became a defaulter and absconded with his employer's money, the latter also a theosophist. A third gave himself up to gross debauchery and confessed it with ineffectual sobs and tears. The fourth got entangled with a person of other sex and fell out with his dearest and truest friends. A fifth showed signs of mental aberration and was brought into court upon charges of discreditable conduct. A sixth shot himself to escape the consequences of criminality on the verge of detection. And Madame Blavatsky says that all these were apparently sincere searchers after truth and passed in the world for respectable persons. Externally, they were fairly eligible as candidates for discipleship, as appearances go, but within, all was rottenness and dead men's bones. So rushing into the path of discipleship without having firmly laid roots in the basic requirements like perfect physical health, absolute mental and physical purity, unselfishness, truthfulness, belief in the law of karma, courage, intuitional perception of the spirit, and calm indifference for everything that is objective and physical and transitory. If these requirements are not taken care of and one enters into become a path of disciple, even worse fate befalls. One may become a passive instrument for foreign influences. Elementals and elementaries become worst of mediums. So this is the warning given out in the theosophical literature before one rushes into the path of discipleship. So the theosophical literature says that to begin with, one must really understand his or her own real nature. And with the understanding of one's his or her own real nature, a realization dawns on each and every one of us that essentially we are all the same and we are from the same source. With that also comes an idea as to what is the purpose of manifestation of this universe, that is for the experience and emancipation of the soul, and an understanding as to what we should do in our life, an understanding as to what is our duty to do that which is due to others, which if left undone leaves us spiritually bankrupt. These are the few of the basic conceptions entering into a path of discipleship. But if one were to rush, danger lurks around every corner. Not only the person will harm himself, but he will harm those around him. His family, his friends, society at large. Therefore, the call is for each one of us to study and exemplify what we study in the theosophical literature and then see where he stands on this path to discipleship. With that, we can conclude this short talk of this evening, and we can consider any questions or any contributions from the participants as regards the topic, this evening's short talk, the path to discipleship.